Welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, A.C. Felder. Today the topic is Christianity and World History. And to talk with me about this, I have a very special guest, Ted Wright. Let me tell you about Ted. Ted has a bachelor in archaeology. He has a master's in apologetics from Southern Evangelical Seminary. He is a recognized scholar of history. He has appeared in a documentary on a History Channel entitled Mankind, The Story of Us. He's also executive director of Cross Examine with a frequent guest of mine, Dr. Frank Turek. He's also adjunct professor at Southern Evangelical Bible College and New Life Theological Seminary. Welcome to the show, Ted.
Thank you, Harold. Appreciate you having me on, man.
Yeah, this is how this came up, is that I heard that you were going to be speaking at the Apologetics Conference and that you were going to be speaking on I'm not sure of the topic, but I remember in the email it talked about you appearing on the History Channel as a Christian.
Yes.
As a Christian scholar. And it really sort of made me think, because every time I look at every time I look at the History Channel, it's either right before Christmas or right before Easter, and that's when they do all their Christian shows, and it's either about how we can't trust the resurrection or how we can't trust Christianity.
Yes.
So I was very surprised when you said that you were going to be a guest on the History Channel.
I know.
How did that come about?
That's funny, Harold, that you say that, because that's exactly what I thought as well when they called me. I actually got an email, and it was one of their producers, and they asked me if I would be willing to fly to New York and be recorded to be on the History Channel. And I said, well, what's the topic going to be about? They told me what it was, and I said, well, are you aware of my, positions and where I teach? And they said, yes, we are, and in fact, that's why we'd like you to be on the show. And so I was kind of like, okay. And so I was a little taken back as well. But they did assure me that one of the reasons why they wanted to have me on is to represent the Christian side of things. So that was sort of the reason why I was asked to be on the show.
Now, what was this project that they're doing?
All I know is it's still in production, so I don't know too much about it. But
okay.
The name of it is called Mankind, The Story of Us. And it is one of the History Channel's most ambitious documentaries that they've ever made. And it's going to be, I believe, a 12-part documentary on the history of the human race, beginning with the Stone Age and going all the way to the modern world and even into the future. And so one of the aspects they asked me about was Christianity and the Roman Empire. That was one of the areas that they kind of focused on.
Well, I am really glad that they recognize that Christianity has a place in world history, and you can't talk about world history without talking about Christianity.
Absolutely, yes.
And so that got me to thinking about doing a show on something similar.
Yes.
So I wanted to talk about Christianity and world history, and let's start back in the beginning. Let's go back to the children of Israel. Let's look at what the world looked like when God first started giving his revelation to his chosen people. What type of environment, what type of a world were we dealing with that they came into the picture on?
Well, it's a great question, Harold, and I guess you could answer that question in one of several different ways. Obviously, if a person believes in the Bible, that the Bible is giving accurate historical information, human history began in a garden some time ago in ancient Mesopotamia, at Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve. But technically, I guess your question would be, what was the world like when God began to reveal? One of the very first men that God called was a man by the name of Abram. Whose name was later changed to Abraham, and he lived in Mesopotamia. We know archaeologically, historically, we know a lot about Mesopotamia. It was polytheistic, and it was saturated with paganism and different things like that. It was very urban as well. Well, in certain aspects of Mesopotamia were very urban. They had irrigation in large cities and things like that. But God called Abram out of this culture to go to a land he was going to show him. So that was the first time that God called a man and began to reveal himself to this man named Abraham.
Yeah, and what's really interesting about that is where they're at.
Yes.
And they're in the center of the world, basically. And God called them to that place.
Yes.
The place that's always involved in something that's going on in the world, and has always been involved in it since then. And that God said that this is the land that I want for you.
Yeah.
And this is the land that I'm promising you. And whenever God's dealing with them, even when he said, I got to get rid of you because you're just so disobedient. But he didn't say, okay, I'm going to send you to some other country and then I'm going to join you there.
Yes.
He says, no, I'm going to bring you back here to this place in the center of the world where they're always in the middle of everything.
Absolutely.
Where they can influence everything.
Absolutely. It's interesting. It's interesting the location where, if you look at a map of Israel today, and you look at the neighbors to the north, the neighbors to the south, there's Egypt, there's Saudi Arabia. To the north, there's Lebanon, then Syria, then you know, a little bit to the northeast, you have Iran and Iraq. And so even historically, this the Israelites have always been in a place where they could have maximum impact in world affairs, even as far back as, you know, the time of Abraham. And so God called Abraham and the Israelites to live in that particular part of the world. And if you look at the original extent of the boundaries, it's pretty broad. It's actually much broader than modern day Israel today. But someone is actually in one of my atlases that I have, Bible atlases. They've actually drawn a little pinpoint on, if you take a Jerusalem and you actually draw a circle around Jerusalem, it actually contains most of the world's major cities within 600 or 700 miles within a radius of Jerusalem. So,
wow.
So historically, Israel has always held a very important aspect. In fact, Alexander the Great marched through there. The Caesars marched through there. The Egyptians marched through there. So they were put there for a specific reason, and that was to have maximum impact on world affairs.
And you mentioned maximum impact. Now, what type of impact did they have? What type of what did they bring to the world that wasn't there before?
Well, that's another great question, Harold. One of the things that they were supposed to bring as a people of God, it goes all the way back in the book of Deuteronomy, God wanted them to specifically follow Him, to obey His laws. And when they did that, if they were to follow God and obey His laws and be a righteous people and take care of each other, take care of the land and do the things that God told them to do, God said, I'm going to, you're going to be a witness to the nations, and they're going to see how what a wise and understanding people is, and they're going to want to worship God. So they were, it's kind of sort of an evangelistic purpose for them to exist.
Right.
And we know that there were periods in their history in which they did do that, but then there, most of the history was, spotted with failure and, they didn't, inconsistency, if you will.
Right.
They didn't actually follow their end of the bargain. But God has always maintained His end of the bargain, so they were driven out of the land when they disobeyed God, and then they would be brought back into the land if they obeyed God and turned to God with all their heart.
Right.
So, very interesting thing, too, and you hadn't said this, but one of the very interesting things about the modern state of Israel is that there are actually Bible prophecies that predicted that God would gather them from the four corners of the world and bring them back into the land. So, it's interesting where they are, just geographically.
Right. And another thing I find really interesting is that when we look at the Old Testament, when it's being written, when we look at some of the prophets like Isaiah, and we look at what's going on in world history at that time, then we see some of these philosophers who are starting to ask these questions.
Yes.
They're starting to ask the very important questions of, who am I? Where did I come from? Where do I go? What is my purpose?
Yes.
And it's around the same time that God has given these prophets these answers that man is yearning for.
Yes. Well, it depended on what time frame you're talking about. You know, the Greeks were writing in about 300 BC, that time frame. That's Aristotle and Socrates and Plato and those guys. The Hebrew prophets would have been writing, God appearing to Abraham would have been maybe 2300 BC, roughly that time frame. And then Moses would have been about 1440 to 1446 BC. So they were before even the Greeks. But the Greeks began to, again, think outside, more not in religious terms, but in more philosophical terms. But the questions were there, and the Hebrews, of course, began to answer those questions about ultimate reality and ultimate meaning.
Right. And the whole monotheism thing, which was a little bit different than the environment around them. And when you look at some of the philosophical concepts and how new it was, for instance, when you look at Plato and his idea that, matter had to exist eternally because what other options were there?
Yeah.
There was no such thing. I mean, the thought wasn't even around that. Oh, God creates out of nothing.
Yes.
Ex nihilo. So, I mean, just those things, those are completely unheard of and completely different.
Yeah.
And mankind was getting a very good insight into what actually happened.
And that's the amazing thing about the nature of inspiration, the miracle of inspiration. One of the claims that Christians make is, and I think it can be grounded in truth and reality. One of the claims of the uniqueness of the Christian Bible. And again, Christians also recognize the Hebrew Bible as well, right. You know, Genesis through Malachi. But one of the miracles, one of the claims is that it is inspired. And it's not just like, oh, it just inspires me because it's good poetry. But the claim of inspiration is the claim that it bears the mark of the divine, that it is God's very word. And so one of the natures of inspiration is the fact that God is revealing these things to these men, and they probably didn't even fully understand what they were saying as well.
Exactly.
So, for instance, when God says, and Moses writes in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You know, Moses is of course, trying to convey to the Hebrew people where they came from. But as it turns out, and if you look at cosmology today, especially Big Bang cosmology, it almost identically matches,
right.
The science identically matches what the Bible says in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, that a finite time ago, the universe came into existence out of nothing.
Right.
So the amazing thing about inspiration and these prophets was that they said things, and they couldn't have known him by themselves. They didn't have telescopes or microscopes.
Right.
So it had to have been something else going on there. And it's not just with Genesis 1. The Bible is replete with amazing examples of prophecy and science and insights into history.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the claim of inspiration is that the Bible is true in everything that it teaches, whether it touches on history or science or whatever else it is.
Yeah, I think one of my favorite examples is Isaiah. And Isaiah is writing to the children of Israel who haven't even gone into captivity yet.
Yes.
And he's saying, you're going to go into captivity.
Yeah.
You're going to be in captivity for 70 years. Then there's going to be this king named Cyrus who's going to lead you out of captivity.
Yeah.
They weren't even in captivity at the time.
Yeah.
I mean, how powerful is that? But overall, the Bible itself, fitting into world history.
Yes.
How important is the Bible to world history?
That's another excellent question, Harold. Let me go back, and this is going to be, I've been thinking about that question. One of the things, you know, when you look at the Bible, it's been around and different people have had different canons, different collections of ancient writings and texts. You know, the Catholics have theirs and Protestants have their particular collection of books. But let me just go back, just for the sake of argument, let me go back to like the invention of the printing press,
mm-hmm.
by Johann Gutenberg in the 1500s. You know, we think of things today like going viral, like a YouTube video or something on the internet, like an article or Twitter or something like that. Well, the interesting thing about the Bible is that the Bible is one of the very first things to go viral. And the very first book that was published was the Bible by Gutenberg. And then it just starts spreading like wildfire. And another coincidence of history, if you will, that happens to coincide that the Protestant Reformation happened right as the printing press is being invented, and so Bibles began to proliferate all throughout Europe. And then, of course, you had people wanting to get the Bible in their own language. So so the influence of the Bible, I mean, you've got, the Renaissance, and you've got great artists like Leonardo da Vinci and Michelangelo, and then, other aspects as well. I'm trying to think of the other, Dante and Milton, Shakespeare. From a literary standpoint, the Bible has had its enormous impact on world affairs and world history. And not only that, also in documents as well, such as our Constitution. You know, in an indirect way, many of the founding fathers of America were very devout believers. Not all of them were, but many of them were, and drew inspiration from Scripture. The Magna Carta in Europe, and also the Constitution, or the Declaration of Independence in the United States of America. So the Bible has had a tremendous impact on world affairs.
Okay, so we see how the history was changed through the Bible. We see how it was changed through that nation of Israel. Explain to us what the world was like right before Christianity came onto the scene.
Before Christianity came on the scene? Well, it, of course, was the Roman Empire. Was gaining in power, and going back in the book of Daniel, wrote during the time of Nebuchadnezzar, thereabouts, in that general time frame, during the Babylonian exile, which is around 300-400 BC, and so 486 BC, somewhere in that time frame. The dates fluctuate back and forth, but their general time frame is that's it. Daniel predicted that there's going to be an empire rise up in his prophecies, and he actually predicted the downfall of Babylon, which happened. He also predicted the rise of Greece, which happened the downfall of Greece and the rise of Rome, and that's exactly what we see in between the Testaments. We see the rise, the fall of, we see the rise of Alexander the Great, and that historically was important as well, because when Alexander the Great conquered the world, I mean, there no one has ever, in fact, there's only other one other conqueror who's actually conquered more than Alexander the Great. Interestingly, it's actually Genghis Khan, the Mongolian. But Alexander the Great, one of the things he did was he spread Hellenism, and Hellenism is Greek culture.
Right.
And Greek culture, part of it was the Greek language. So the Greek language began to be the lingua franca, the spoken language of the common people in that part of the world. So when the Romans came on, they built roads, and they built cities and roads and infrastructure. So by the time Christianity came on the scene, things were in place historically to really, for Christianity to have a major impact in world history. Not just Israel, but also Christianity because of the Roman Empire.
Right. Now, in those early years of Christianity, what type of impact did Christianity make on this immediate culture?
Well, not immediately. It wasn't an immediate impact. You know, going back, it's an interesting coincidence, and not coincidence, but an interesting thing in history. And it's true back then, and I think it's true today. And that is that sometimes little small things that seem insignificant have tremendous consequences. To give you an example, I'm going to answer your question, but to give you an example, like let's say the Romans, when they were crucifying Jesus of Nazareth in Jerusalem, outside the walls of Jerusalem, mm-hmm. I don't think they fully, obviously they didn't because they're Romans, you know, pagans. They didn't fully understand the impact that 300 years later, Christianity was going to be the official religion of the Roman Empire.
Right.
They didn't understand that 300 years later, the Caesar himself would become a Christian. And so so immediately when Christianity came on the scene, it was tried to be stamped out, but it didn't happen. And so it wasn't an immediate effect.
Yeah. Now, I do know that there was some things that did happen locally as far as orphanages were created. I think the Romans had a habit of, if they had a child that they didn't want,
yes,
they would just leave it out.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, Christians, the Romans would practice, you know, if you had a child, especially if it was a girl, you could leave, or baby, you could leave it on the side of the road, and eventually Christians got that outlawed in the Roman Empire. And little things like that began to have an impact on Roman law. And so they had that impact there. But slowly Christianity began to influence the Roman Empire and the people of Rome.
Yeah, and I also noticed that when we look at the culture before Christianity, and this is really interesting because Christianity is accused of the exact opposite. We look at what the rights of women were and the place of women in society prior to Christianity. And we look at it afterwards and we see that Christianity was actually responsible for bringing a lot of rights and privileges to women.
Absolutely, Harold. And not just women, but also slavery as well. There were slavery in the Roman Empire and the gladiatorial games. They were killing people in the Colosseum in Rome. And Christians were responsible for overthrowing the gladiatorial games. The Romans didn't like that, but they said it was barbaric. So not only that, but also hospitals were founded by Christians.
Yeah.
There were hospitals in other places, but Christians were the ones who founded hospitals, and then eventually later began to found universities. Universities were begun by Christians. Actually, began in churches where you would go and learn Latin and Greek and probably Plato and Aristotle and the Bible. So Christians started universities as well. So that's another very positive impact Christianity's had.
What do we have in our society now around us that are remnants of Christianity that we probably don't even realize?
Well, again, the other one I mentioned was hospitals.
Right.
If you see a hospital today, if you see a university, it depends on which culture you're in. But respect for women and respect for people who are poor. The helping the poor, things like that. Charities began as Christian charities. Now there are many charities today. Not trying to take anything away from other charities, but charities in the ancient world, many of them, especially in the Roman Empire, were founded by Christians.
And when you look at world disasters, it's usually America that comes to the rescue. We're the first ones there.
Absolutely.
And it's because of that foundation that we had in Christianity.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's not the United Nations. It's the United States of America that's there.
Exactly. Exactly.
And first ones to give.
Christians by far, and I'll mention, I hope it's okay to mention the name, but even a local ministry here in the Charlotte area is Billy Graham and Samaritan's Purse. You know,
yeah.
When the Japanese tsunami hit about a year or so ago, it was Samaritan's Purse who were the first ones to go in there. So this is just carrying on tradition. You know, you hear all the bad stuff about what Christians do, but
right.
It's not, you know, any wars that anybody starts in the name of Christianity is really not Christianity.
No, exactly. And we're going to actually get to that. Matter of fact, let's go ahead and get to that now, because
okay.
We've talked about some of the positive impacts of Christianity, but then there are objections.
Yes.
Because people, because there are people who have this Christianity bad.
Yeah.
that just summarizes in a nutshell.
All Christianity's bad.
Right, right. Well, let's look at first the thing about God and the Old Testament. And it just seemed like God was just like this really angry guy. And he ordered the children of Israel to go into the land and to kill the Canaanites. I mean, not just, you know, convert them, or not just evangelize them, but to kill them, to kill the women, the children, the cattle, the cats, the dogs, the mice, everything.
Exactly, yeah.
And so how do you respond to that objection? Because that objection seems to fly in the face of the love that we hear Christianity supposedly portray.
That's a common objection that you hear today, and you still hear it by many people today. The Bible says that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. It doesn't change. And so, you know, people will bring up the Canaanite genocide command in the Old Testament as proof that God is some type of moral monster, that he's some type of evil. If there is a God, then he's really, really a bad God. And a lot of people really don't have a problem with theism per se or belief in God. They just, if there's a God, he's certainly not the God of the Bible. And so they point out to the Canaanite. But you can't just take the Bible. The thing with the Bible, you can't just take the parts that you like or the parts that you agree with and make a doctrine out of them. You have to take the whole Scripture together. And the Bible is very clear that God is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so the Old Testament does present this image of God. It's seemingly like he's evil. But I would challenge anybody who really thinks that's a challenge to read the entire Old Testament and see how God dealt with Israel, the nation Israel, and how many times he told them to obey him, and yet
right.
he acted in grace and mercy. He did not give them what they deserved. But there are times in which God does react in judgment. And so with the Canaanites, he was using the Israelites to judge them because of sins that they had done. They
right.
were practicing child sacrifice. They were practicing
right.
bestiality. They were practicing idolatry. And so according to Old Testament law, those things were deserving of death. Now, obviously, the Israelites did that as well. And when the Israelites committed those sins,
right.
God sent other nations to take them out as well, such as
right.
ancient Assyria and Babylonia.
Right.
So people will have a problem with other nations judging Israel. But when God tells the Israelites to go and judge these other nations, then they have a problem with that.
And it's really interesting because the fact that you mentioned, and I remember when God was speaking, I think it was to Abraham, and he said, you know, your people are going to come back here in 400 years because their sin has not reached that level yet.
Yes.
Because it goes back to what you're saying. God was giving them
yes, time.
400 years, he's saying, look,
yeah.
I'm giving y'all time
Grace.
To get your act together.
Grace.
And after 400 years, even God is, you know, even God, as slow as he is to anger,
yeah.
doesn't mean that he's not just.
God is gracious and compassionate, slow to anger and abounding in love.
Right.
That statement is from Moses. From Moses.
Right, right.
And, you know, and throughout the Old Testament, God sent this prophet named Hosea. And he went to tell, he said, go take a wife of prostitution. Go take a wife who's a prostitute. And here's the imagery. The imagery is that Hosea was the faithful husband and his wife Gomer was the unfaithful wife. That was a picture of God in Israel.
Right.
That God, he said to go out to her, even if she sins against you and goes against you, I still want you to go out and I want you to pursue her and show her love, because that's why the way I am with Israel.
Right.
Even though they sin against me, I still love them and I still want to have this relationship with these people of Israel.
Right.
So it's a God of grace. Even in the Garden of Eden, when he told Adam and Eve, the day you eat the fruit, you're surely going to die. But he didn't act in judgment. He acted in mercy, and he provided coverings for them. So God is a merciful God. In the New Testament, Jesus makes a whip, and drives out the money changers. And he tells the Pharisees and Sadducees that they're whitewashed sepulchers, and he calls them a brood of vipers.
Yeah.
So Jesus, there's wrath in Jesus and love in Jesus, and there's wrath and love in the Old Testament God. They're the same God. Jesus and Jehovah are the same God.
Yes.
That's the claim. That's the Christian claim. That's what Jesus claimed.
Well, here's another one, and it's sort of related, and that is the whole Crusades. And the Crusades is supposed to show the intolerance and cruelty of Christianity.
Yeah, that's another one. The Crusades have been another one of those things, kind of like the Canaanite genocide. But let me just point out, Harold, that the Crusades is not what Christianity is about. Christianity doesn't spread by the sword, and God never made a command in the Old Testament or New Testament to go and drive out people who occupy the Holy Land.
Right.
Now, let me just say, and I know this is a sensitive topic for a lot of people, the first Crusaders, many of them, I think there's mixed ideas in the Crusades, because there were some people who were faithful, some people who were doing it for noble reasons, other people for not so noble reasons. But the bottom line is that that's not Christianity.
Right.
The Crusades and what the Crusaders did was not Christianity. Jesus told us to love our neighbors, to pray for those who persecute us. And so whatever the Crusaders did was something that we Christians disagree with. So we would agree with the skeptics and the people who are critics of Christianity when they point out that the Crusades were a horrible thing that in the name of Christianity. But they'll point out as well, I mean, Islam does the same thing. So, you know, I'm not saying it's right. One's right. They're both wrong, I think,
right,
to try to spread a religion by the sword, by compulsion.
Right.
But the Crusaders believe that they were going to free the Holy Land so that the Christians can go and
we're running out of time. I just want to do this last one. The Dark Ages. I call it the Dark Ages because evidently the church suppressed knowledge. So, you know, you can't trust the church because, you know, you'll be living in the Dark Ages again.
Exactly. And that goes back to the, you know, and that whole term Dark Ages. In history, historians look at history in three ways: ancient, medieval, and modern. Ancient would be, you know, the Egyptians, the Greeks, the Romans. Medieval, of course, would be maybe possibly beginning with the Norman conquest in 1066. And then modern would be probably beginning in the time of Isaac Newton. So the Dark Ages were a pejorative term that were given by these Enlightenment historians to the period of the Middle Ages and even before that, because science had not yet come on the scene. So when science comes on the scene, this provides enlightenment and knowledge. And so now we're not in the Dark Ages anymore. Now we've got science to illuminate us.
Yeah.
And so the whole term the Dark Ages is just really a misnomer. It's not a good name for that period. Because in the Middle Ages, the clock was invented, which is a very, very modern device. There's lots of other things that were done in the Middle Ages. The universities were founded in the Middle Ages. And so the Enlightenment, the European Enlightenment, really was kind of, they were trying to get away from the Middle Ages, and they were trying to get away from the period in which theology and the Bible played a prominent role in science and history. In fact, there was no really separation between science and faith back then.
Okay.
So,
well, we've come to the end of the show. I'd like to thank you very, very much for being on the show, Ted Wright, talking with me about Christianity and world history. And that will end this episode of Giving an Answer. Be sure to join me again next time. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
You can find out more about Giving an Answer, as well as listen to other episodes, by visiting us online at www.givinganswer.org.